The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I will show you that I'm going to spend a fair amount of time talking about Luther, a lecture on Luther, a lecture on Zwingli and Bullinger, a lecture on Calvin, and then out of that, some of the aftermath of the later covenant theology. So I put a high deal of emphasis on the early reformational side. So half of my lectures, at least, if not more, I've still determined finally where I go. But at least the first three lectures are going to emphasize the earliest reformers, which almost looks strange because a lot of people come in with the idea that covenant theology started with the Puritans in New England, for example. It's not true. That is a terrible misrepresentation of the Reformed tradition. And we need to go back and realize where these ideas really began and see how that impacts later thinking. Okay, so my purposes in this course are to get you to think about the very earliest part of the Reformed tradition and see that covenant theology is already coming into its own. In fact, an interesting point to know is that in 1534, Heinrich Bullinger writes a treatise called Of the One and Eternal Testament or Covenant of God. It is the first monograph on the covenant ever written in the history of the church. That's his distinction. That's only 17 years after the 95 Theses were nailed to the door. That's early Reformation. And we already have a unique thesis on the covenant from a Reformed leader. Shows you how early the ideas are emerging. This is not a later thing. It's very early. We need to see that. I'm going to try to show you how that actually emerges in some ways even out of the struggles of late medieval theology, which is what we're going to pick up in our first lecture. Yes, sir. Tim. Well, we'll touch on it a lot in the class today. So I'll just hold off the course, that discussion for the later part of this class. In fact, one of the articles I've given you will deal with that, okay, and probably in our second hour today. Okay? Anything else? Okay? The first thing that I've given to you, again, I realize in a class like this, many of you may already have a very deep training in the covenant and all those sorts of things, but because the THM PhD course broadens outside of Westminster students. Some of you are coming, and this is maybe, to some extent, a new exposure to covenantal thought. So I'm sharing with you now an article that comes from the New Dictionary of Theology that I've composed. And I'd like to just take a quick survey, and I won't pick up all the things that are here, but let's just hit some of the highlights, and we'll just walk through the article here as an introduction of some of the biblical notions of the covenant and some of the like a broad survey of the history of Christian theology of the covenant. Okay, let's begin. First of all, in the Bible, it's important to be aware that the word covenant, the word berit, is really a word that seems to imply a cutting. And so the idea of cutting a covenant, that is actually a metaphor in the English language when we say we struck a bargain. You know, we killed it, we slew a bargain, we cut a covenant. That's actually an English idiom that comes from that Hebraic notion. So, for example, you can find it in Genesis 15 when Abram parts the various animals and the burning furnace passes between the parts with the smoke coming out representing a theophany, if you will. And in Psalm 50 and verse 5, it talks about those who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. Okay, so sacrifice, covenant go together. Significant that in the Old Testament that the movement of the covenant is from God to man. For example, the next paragraph says, the covenants are started with God's declaration, I will establish my covenant. And so there is this emphasis on the fact that the covenant initiates unconditionally with God. It's not man sitting down to bargain but rather it is the conquering king who comes to his people. That gets us into the Meredith Klein notion of the suzerainty treaty, ancient Near Eastern literature, as the idea that that's the conquering king that sets the terms of the covenant. It's not equals. It's a superior. It says, I make my covenant with you. Okay, by grace, God brings us into covenant. So the next thing I say, while the covenant is unilateral in establishment, it is mutual or two-sided in accomplishment. This accents the importance of personal sanctification and perseverance. Therefore, in Scripture, we find God commanding his people to keep the covenant through love and obedience. Okay, another important thought, not only do we see then the idea of the initiation of the covenant and the mutuality of the covenant, we should also get into the hermeneutical realm biblically. Are there many covenants, or is there ultimately only one covenant? How do we look at that question? And so, one of the issues hermeneutically, we read, although there are several covenants in the Old Testament, they are considered as one covenant by the Old Testament itself. There are many examples that I note here for you where the covenant is being used singularly, but it's going back to look at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses, and Israel, all within the word covenant singular. So the Bible suggests that even though there are historical manifestations of the covenant, there still is a unity. There is a singularity of the covenant. And theologians have suggested the idea then of the covenant of grace. One of the great tensions in the history of the covenant is, how does the Mosaic era of the covenant, the Mosaic dispensation, Reformed theologians were not afraid to call it dispensation. The Reformed tradition has some kind of an idea of an economy of the covenant history. How does that fit in with the covenant of grace? How does law fit with grace? And so you get into now the great tension between law versus gospel or law in grace. The difference between Reformed and Lutheran theology comes to bear right out of this biblical point. How do we put them together? Okay. It's interesting that we also have the question of how does the new covenant tie in with the old? Is the new covenant a true expression of what God was doing with Israel, or is it something entirely distinct? And you may be surprised that Luther at some point sounds very much like a modern dispensationalist. Now, he is not a dispensationalist, don't get me wrong. But in making a strong distinction between the covenant of the New Testament and God's covenant with the Old, Luther makes a very substantial break, whereas the Reformed tradition is going to argue for continuity. Okay? That issue, hermeneutically, comes to us biblically in some of these passages, and it will be reflected in the history of that we'll be looking at. Okay? Further, the next paragraph, Israel's history reveals that the gracious covenant of God is violated by their infidelity. And there even seems to be times when it's implied that God breaks his covenant. Now that really gets hard, because we're talking about what seems to be God's sovereign movement in history to establish covenant, writing the law upon the heart, and yet there's covenant breaking. In a sense where God himself disowns his people. He divorces them, which is a breaking of the covenant. How does that all fit in together? That may sound a little bit like what Arminius might have been trying to say when he taught the covenant, that election is conditional, that God is in covenant, but then he can break it. Is that true? So that's part of the Reformed tradition. Don't forget that Arminius was a Reformed theologian that was coming out of that stream, and he breaks with it. And he's struggling to some extent with the issue of conditionality and election. How does it all go together? There's a covenantal question. And that suggests perhaps, especially chapter 11, in mind, to be granted by the people, and that work of the Messiah and also the Holy Spirit. So then the question is, how do we take the great contrast between the covenant in Jeremiah 31, where it says the old covenant that my people broke, and I'm making a new covenant, it's not like that one. How is the new covenant possibly the same as the old covenant when God himself distinguishes them? That's a real hermeneutical problem for the Reformed tradition to deal with. What about Hebrews 8, where he says the old has become obsolete when God has made anew? Seems to be a strong break. Reformed covenantal thinking has to address that. Now, the Anabaptists might delight in that and say, now, wait a second. Doesn't it seem to me that there's a break, that we're not in the old covenant? How can we appeal to the old covenant as the basis of infant baptism by circumcision when the old covenant's obsolete and passed away? How can the Christian appeal to that? So we're going to find the Anabaptists debating with Zwingli right on that hermeneutical issue. How do you put those two together? That'll come up. We'll find it. You see, the Bible doesn't change. It's the same text. So the great history are built upon some of these hermeneutical questions. Well, then when we come to the New Testament, again, just to get some of the biblical context of where their history will flow from, the New Testament, the distinction between the Old and New Covenants comes from the Scriptures themselves. In other words, we have to recognize there is an old and a new, the former and the later, that which is obsolete and that which God is establishing in the new. So what do we do with that distinction? How does that impact our understanding of the covenant scripturally as we develop our theology? One of the questions that comes out of this is, the old covenant really the covenant of works, whereas the new covenant is the covenant of grace? To what extent does the covenant of works in creation continue on? Or is it totally abrogated? How is Christ fulfilling the old covenant? I mean, all of those things are part of the tradition that we're going to be reading in. The struggle, how does old covenant, new covenant relate? To what extent are they parallel with theological covenant of works and grace? How does that all go together? Are they the same? Are they different? Then, of course, we come to Christ himself, the great incarnate gift of God, of the God-man. And it's interesting to note that in the New Testament, he is tied in with the covenant on various points, and especially the Lord's Supper. We find this is the new covenant in my blood, as we find in the teaching of the Lord's Supper. So how does that covenantal thought tie in the history of redemption? And it's fascinating how Zwingli will point out that God proves the covenant in the most dramatic way in Jesus Christ. I will be your God and you'll be my people. Bringing God and man together in the incarnation, we see the covenant lived out in Christ. He is God and man in one. He is the covenant in his incarnation. He is the God-man. I will be your God, you'll be my people. And here's Jesus, the God-man. So that's an interesting insight. So there's Christological concerns that grow out of covenantal thinking. The new era in no way diminishes God's demand for a covenant-keeping people. Hence, the new covenant itself promises the ability to keep the covenant as one of its greatest benefits. So in what sense now do we come to the new covenant and hear the promise that in the new covenant, God himself writes the law in our hearts? And he forgives our sins. That sovereign gift of grace, how does that balance with responsibility? And when do we move from the gracious doctrine of justification by faith alone to neo-nomianism and Puritan excessive works requirements, if that exists, and the morphology of conversion? That's a covenantal question. And what do we do with a halfway covenant? You know, we've got this new era now, and we've got children that have been brought into the church, who've been baptized, and they've grown up and they've never professed their faith in Christ, and God's supposed to do it, but we're doing the covenant sign. Now they've had children, should they be baptized or not? Since their parents have never professed their faith, what do we do? Is the Lord's Supper a converting ordinance? Do you, by participating in the supper, does God grant faith? And therefore, maybe we better let the kids who've grown up as not professing, who have kids who are being baptized, maybe we've got to let them into the supper as covenantal members. So you get into the struggle of what the New England theologians had to do. How does the halfway covenant fit in with this new era of grace? What's God doing? Is it more gracious or less gracious than the old? How do we put it all together? Okay. So we go on, and of course the sacramental life, which we've already mentioned, I'll jump to the last paragraph of the first part of this survey. It says, covenant theologians, with the exception of some Calvinistic Baptists, have argued firstly that the children of Christians are no less in the covenant than the children of the old covenant. Of course, today, that issue is being pressed in a whole new question, which is of pedo-communion. There were little glimmers of that in the Reformation. You may not like hearing this, but Calvin said, anyone that has even a particle of brain would know that God did not intend the supper for children. You may disagree with Calvin. That's how blunt he was about that question. But the point that we should see here is that we're still struggling with covenantal implications. Okay? The New England theologians may have had the question, do we let grown-up children of the covenant come to the supper if they've not professed their faith fully? We're dealing with the question, what about our newborn children? Should they be brought automatically in? And so those from the Baptist tradition that disagree entirely say, you guys are in real problems. The only solution is to give up infant baptism, because there's only one logical conclusion, give them both sacraments. Okay, so the issues are still living. The debate is not done. We still live with the debate of the covenant, what it means. And that issue will impact your life in a big way, wherever you come down, who you put your credentials with as a minister, who you can teach for and who you can't teach for. It's a big issue. Okay, so it's not just historical. An interesting biblical study has profound implications for the life of the church and your personal life. So it's a rich area. I think what you study here will stay with you the rest of your life. That's how important it is, in my opinion. Okay? Any comments or questions you might want to make on that very brief a biblical survey? Not to say that it's all there. I hope you read it more fully. And there are a lot of other good works that would go far deeper than that introduction. Well, let's introduce the next part quickly. We'll take a break in just a few moments, but let me just sketch what the second part of our survey will do. I want to point out to you that because the covenant idea is biblical, that suggests that there has been a discussion of the covenant since the ancient church all the way to the modern age. That in every era, we find the covenant at work. One of the things that I think David Weir does well in his work is he suggests that we need to make the distinction between the covenant idea, covenant theology, and federal theology, that there are different concepts at work here. And to me, I basically agree with him in the sense that the covenant idea, because it's biblical, anyone who's engaged himself directly with the scriptures has had to wrestle with the idea of covenant. What are you going to do with it? You're going to call it a testament or a covenant or a promise or an agreement. What do you do with it? So if you've taught the Bible, we would expect every tradition somehow to deal with the covenant idea. So dealing with the covenant idea is one thing, but what makes your dealing with that biblical idea turn into covenant theology? What makes talking about the covenant a covenant theology? And if there is a covenant theology, maybe there are different streams of covenant theology. If we limit covenant theology, as we often do, to the Reformed tradition, is it legitimate to say there's a point where covenant theology grows from covenant theology to what we could call federal theology, which is an expansion? Or it may be viewed as a deformation. I mean, that's part of the debate. Are they the same? Are they different? And what makes the difference between those two streams? Okay? So when we look at the survey of the history of Christian theology in terms of the covenant, I'd like to suggest that it's probably at the late medieval period that we first begin to see a self-conscious covenantal theology emerging. The covenant has been known and spoken about earlier, but a distinctively self-conscious covenant theology is beginning to emerge under the writings of the late medieval theologians. Gabriel Biel, for example, is one of the fellows we'll talk about at that time. And that gets us into the work of Heiko Obermann in the late medieval tradition. And then when we come into the Reformed sphere, we begin to see that there are various covenantal theologies that are at work, that the early Reformed tradition develops, but there seems to be an Anabaptist covenantal theology at work. How are those interrelated? And Luther himself will talk about the covenant or testament, and what is he doing? So Lutheranism is going to take an approach. And then at some point, there is growth. We don't find clearly in the early reformers the words the covenant of creation or the covenant of works. That comes along later. And is it appropriate then to suggest that we should differentiate that sphere of thinking by a new term called federal theology, where we have a pre-lapsarian and post-lapsarian covenant, somehow in tension or at least in some kind of development? How do we relate them? Okay. So that's what we'll look at in the first part of our second hour. And also then, I'll try to walk you through some of the highlights of this article that I've written, which will answer the question that Tim raised earlier. Okay? So let's take a break. All right, let's pick up now with our survey of the idea of the covenant in terms of ancient church, medieval Reformation, modern church. We have already attempted to introduce a distinction between the covenant idea, covenant theology, and federal theology. Let's just work through the text here again. It says, no systematic use of the covenant emerged during the ancient church. Irenaeus used the idea to defend his premillennialism because of the land promises of the Old Testament covenants, which is a fascinating thing, that you'll remember that premillennialism and covenantal thought are often seen as opposites in this day and age, but one of the most early significant usages was the idea of God's promise of a land that was yet to be given to Israel. God had made a covenant that they would have the land, and that's the premillennial view, which was one of the earlier premillennial varieties of thought. And so a great deal was made of God's covenant promise as with respect to a premillennial scheme under Irenaeus. So if you're doing ancient church research, you may want to look at him. That we're not doing that in this course by my approach, but I would be glad to let you pursue that if you're doing ancient church history, although it's probably not really in the focus of what this program is supposed to do. If you wanted to work on him, I wouldn't mind you doing it if you compared him with a reformational type person, you know, kind of like how's the exegesis of the ancient church and the Reformation or something on some of these texts. That would be a legitimate approach. Okay, Chrysostom spoke of the sacraments of the church's covenant. So one of his phrases regularly talking of baptism and the Lord's Supper were the covenants. So you see the sacramental life of the church and the covenant were already being linked, at least in the minds of Chrysostom in that early stage. And Augustine defined a covenant as an agreement between two parties. He does this several times in his comments or homilies on the Psalms. I think that's fascinating because you remember Augustine was a predestinarian theologian. We think of Augustinianism as the precursor of Calvinism. And yet he is defining the covenant in a mutual way, not as a one-sided sovereign agreement, but even from the early Augustinian sense. Now, I don't list it here, but Weir will point out in his study that there's one point in the City of God, if I'm not mistaken, where even God's relationship with Adam is described as a covenant. So you can even find a seminal notion of a pre-fall covenant suggested by Augustine, not developed, but it's there. So you see, there are little seed ideas that are going to later become very predominant that you can find percolating up eschatological concerns in the covenant. That's a big point of eschatology. The issue of sacraments in the covenant, the mutuality of the covenant, and even a pre-lapsarian covenant. All of those ideas are glimmered in some way in the early fathers, but none of them are systematically developed. So it's difficult to suggest that those would be covenantal theologies. Just because you have a gem of an idea and suggest it, you can't say you've developed it into some kind of a systematic theology or a dominating idea. Okay? So there may be much more there. I would not suggest for a moment that I've mastered that era, but to the extent I've been able to look at it and seen others interacting in early church, ancient church issues, the covenant is not really pursued with any kind of vigor. Secondly, when we move to the medieval church, again, I think we see the covenantal idea being used and perhaps a nascent covenant theology beginning to take form. So the medieval period saw the development of three important ideas associated with the covenant. The first one is with the arrival of papal absolutism in the 11th and following centuries, political thinkers within the church developed the idea of a baptismal covenant of the Christian with the Pope. Isn't that interesting? The Pope, as the vicar of the church, saw himself in a direct covenantal linkage with all of the subjects of Christendom. They had entered into baptism, into infant baptism. They're all part of a covenantal relationship between the Pope and the Christian. And that has profound political implications. So, John, you're mentioning again church and state. Here's an early medieval notion that's quite significant that you may want to explore as well. And that's the whole area of the beginnings of how do we deal with disobedience and covenant breaking and its political implications. So you notice, for example, that failure to obey the Pope resulted in the breach of covenant, which entitled the Pope to resist the power of even a king and to teach his subjects to do the same. Isn't that fascinating? So that the idea of breaking obedience with a magistrate who has broken covenant is a medieval idea worked out between the popes and his subjects. And that becomes very important when you begin to move into the Scottish era, when they are in the process of rebelling against the English king and monarch and queen. It has significance when we come to the United States of America, when they're struggling with the revolutionary model. Is it legitimate? We may not remember this. My most recent area of interest is early American Christianity, and I will not try to get on my hobby horse. I'll leave that entirely out of this class, except for this little glimmer. And that is that when in the early Continental Congress, they called themselves ancient free Protestant colonies in the first journal of the Continental Congress. They were very concerned about the Quebec Act that allowed an establishment of a Roman Catholic state immediately to the north of New England. And they saw that as a real breach of security of the English system of colony life. And so the revolution had a religious focus. They were breaking allegiance with the king to fight for their rights as Protestants. And that's something you'll never hear in the American school system. I was staggered to read that. That's there. The first military work of the revolution was the invasion of Quebec. Imagine that. They were trying to put down a Roman Catholic state for their security. But it is significant. They saw themselves as Protestants. Apparently, King George called the revolution a Scotch-Irish rebellion, meaning they had picked up on the notion of covenantal breaking of a monarch justifying revolt. Where does that come from? That's a covenantal idea. It's not an accident that we establish a federal government in the United States. That is a covenantal government. Where does some of that idea emerge? Well, it has earlier roots here that are significant. So, the idea of the high point of the papal power, you remember at Canossa, has the emperor in a snowstorm, barefooted and penitent, asking the Pope to forgive him and restore him to his crown. See, the baptismal covenant had been breached. Very powerful idea. So here one sees covenant breaking as a ground for resisting political authority. That is an idea that will be very significant in history. And if you're interested in the Reformed tradition, this may be a very significant idea when you get into the French Huguenots and what goes on in France and the religious wars in France. They were very conscious of what it meant to try to obey the king. And Calvin regularly tried to get obedience to the king. After Calvin's death and the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, then what happens? There's warfare. And what is the justification for warfare? And great political treatises emerge in the aftermath of that time. And they deal with covenant. That's a portion of the thinking. So covenantal breaking is a grounds for resisting of political authority. That's a medieval notion that comes to us. Another significant area is the sacramental theologians begin to speak of the saving properties of the Mass's re-sacrifice of Christ as a covenant of God. So, I mean, the biblical word covenant in the Lord's Supper is there, but now the whole idea of the ex opere operato, operation of transubstantiation, is given the language of God's covenant. It is an efficacious covenant that actually accomplishes the forgiveness of sins as it's administered by the Church. And for our purposes, as I have understood the development of the reformational covenant theology, we come to the third area, and I think we can probably begin to move from the covenant idea realm, which probably would govern the first two points, to the idea of a covenantal theology is in this third point. We move from the idea of a covenant usage to now a basic system of covenantal thought beginning to emerge. And this has to do now with the thinking of Gabriel Biel. He is someone who has been well developed by Heiko Obermann in his work, The Harvest of Medieval Theology, among others. So that it would be a significant work to consult if you're interested in late medieval theology in the covenantal form. He helped develop the idea of a covenant of merit, whereby God justified a man for doing his best. His covenant was summarized as, to the ones who do their best, God does not deny grace. Okay, now, since we're in a class where we ought to be exposed to Latin, some of you undoubtedly have studied Obermann, but the key phrase is Deus non denegat gratium. Okay. Quod insa est facientibus. Maybe that facientibus could go here, but in Latin you can put them anywhere you want because of the nature of the language. So what it says is God does not deny grace to the ones that in themselves do things, or to the ones who do what is in themselves. So if you do what's your best ability inside of yourself, God's covenant with you is that that's enough to be right with me. Okay? God demands perfection. He knows he can't get it. But he looks at you and he says, if you've done your very best, that's all you got to do. You know, our theology is still around today, isn't it? This is actually a developed system. It grows out of an earlier problem of covenantal thought, and that is the problem of God's sovereignty. And out of this debate of God's sovereignty, we have the beginnings of two key streams. We can speak of the nominalists and then the Neo-Augustinians. For a work that develops this very helpfully, you may want to consult Obermann's selections from Forerunners of the Reformation, where he'll actually pick up some of the writings of the Neo-Augustinians, which will include Bradwardine, as I recall, and also Staupitz. You remember Staupitz was Luther's spiritual counselor? He was a Neo-Augustinian. And it's very fascinating to see how they were rediscovering God's sovereign grace and all those sorts of things. But now you might say, well, how does the covenant fit into all of this? Well, one of the things that the nominalist theologians began to talk about was the dialectic between God's powers. They developed the notion of God's potentia absoluta and God's potentia ordinata. That is, God's power absolutely means he could have done anything he wanted, for who can stay his hand, as Nebuchadnezzar tells us, I think, in Daniel 4. Who can stop God when he wants to do something? So, could God not have damned the virgin and saved Judas had he wanted to? Who could stop him? In his absolute power, God could do anything. But that kind of God is terrifying. He scares us to death because it is absolutely capricious nature coupled with sovereignty. However, God in His great mercy has ordained that certain things would be. He's given us promises. He's given us His word. He's told us of His nature that does not change. And it's in that dialectic that the idea of covenant emerged, that God has ordained Himself to be a certain way. He's bound Himself to His nature. And in that sense, sovereignty no longer is a terrifying notion, but is something that gives us encouragement. You know what? If you just change the history just a little bit, and you put this into New England, you'd be hearing Perry Miller talking about the Puritans almost. This is actually going on in the medieval period, which is something, there's nothing new under the sun, Koheleth told us, you remember, in Ecclesiastes. Okay, but this dialectic of powers is going on between the potentia absoluta, the potentia ordinata. And so what God in His binding of Himself to deal in a certain consistent manner with His people, He's developed a system of merit. This is how the sinner can be right with God. There are two types of merit. There's the meritum dei condigno and the meritum dei congruo. And in the medieval system now, basically what Beale would be telling us is that God has ordained that a man must be righteous to be with Him. He is a holy God. And in this ordination, He's therefore looking for merit. But how can one be right with God in merit? Well, there's two manners. One is condign merit, which is merit that's truly meritorious. Meritorious merit. You really measure up. There's true dignity to it. But there's also the congruent merit, which means it doesn't measure up, but it's like it. It's approaching it. It's kind of like doing what's the best that's in you. And so out of the de congruo notion, we get this phrase, the facientibus principle. Now, what's significant on the other side with the Neo-Augustinians, you'll remember that the Neo-Augustinians emphasized very strongly God's sovereignty. Okay, that's their whole idea. And so they begin the process of challenging this notion of what we might call some kind of a Pelagian system, where a man is doing what he can. They challenge the renewed Pelagianism with a renewed Augustinianism. Know that it's sovereign grace. And in this context, when you read Staupitz and others, there is clearly an elevating of Christ's significance. So you can see Luther studying in the context of a Neo-Augustinian system and the dialectic here. There's a great seedbed for some of the emergence of his thought of justification by faith alone. Okay, so this is the debate of the late medieval period. This was already a developed covenant theology. We could call it nominalist covenant theology. It's developing the notion of how a man can deal with a sovereign God and yet do it on a Pelagianistic manner. Isn't that fascinating? The covenant makes God approachable as a Pelagian, even though He's absolutely sovereign. That's what it amounts to. See, they don't deny God's sovereignty. They affirm it. They affirm He's consistent. The problem is, what is the method He's ordained? So it's out of that dialectic of sovereignty that we find covenant emerging. And that's one of the great issues later, is how can covenant and sovereignty fit together? And that's one of the questions historians have struggled with when we come to the Reformers, and especially Calvin. So into that context, then, we begin to move with Luther. Notice the end of item B3 that we were looking at. It says, this doctrine of justification by works in God's covenant of merit. And by the way, the word justification was used in this context by Beale, that God justifies this man. So justification was actually developed in that language, in the setting. It was His covenant to justify the one who does what is within Himself. It's in that context that Luther comes to his rediscovery of justification by faith around 1517, and he became an earnest opponent of medieval covenant theology. I think when we lecture on Luther, probably we'll get into this at length next time. We'll pick up on this notion and go beyond it and try to show how Luther moves from the earlier view to his later view and the shifts in his thinking on covenant. They are very traceable. His lectures on the Psalms show us that he's basically not even a neo-Augustinian. He sounds a lot more like he's in the nominalist camp. So, and as he struggles, little by little, we find him moving to more of an Augustinian view. And then how does that affect the mutuality of the covenant? We're going to find that Luther's reaction to medieval theology is to come along with a one-sided testament. See, a testament changes the notion of mutuality. Gets more the idea of a sovereign bequeathal. It's a testament. It's interesting that when Bullinger will write his treatise, he will say of the one testament or covenant of God, reminding us that we can look at this covenant not only as a one-sided bestowal, but also as a mutual. And that's good. And you can trace this in Luther, and we'll do this next time. Okay? Well, then when we come to the Reformation period, I would like to suggest, just for the sake of overview, that we will find that Luther, by and large, jettisons covenant thought. Because for him, in essence, it suggests something of this medieval merit system. Next is that into that context, early on, we find Zwingli emerging. And Zwingli, in God's providence, was a Swissman and not a German. And that already caused enough problems to get along with between Zwingli and Luther. But not only was there that tension, there was also a question, to what extent was Zwingli dependent upon Luther in the discovery of the gospel? Zwingli said, I learned it from Christ through the scriptures. I didn't learn it from Luther. I learned it studying the Bible. So there's even that sense of where Luther says, no, you got it from me. And he's, no, you didn't get it from me. I'm from you. And the egos and the discoveries and the national rivalries are all at work. But it is interesting that one of the things that happens, and we'll see this when we look at Zwingli, is that Luther will eventually look at Zwingli and say that you are just of the papists. Your doctrine of obedience is the same as Rome's, because you're talking about the necessity of obedience. Because Zwingli will say the law and the gospel are one and the same. Okay, well, and Luther says, no, the law and the gospel are absolutely different. And Zwingli is going to come at that because you may be amazed at this because of his understanding of the covenant coming out of Genesis 17. We're going to go back and look at that. We'll see that Zwingli and Bullinger are going to say that when the Lord says to Abram in Genesis 17:1, walk before me and be blameless, he is bringing together justification and obedience into the believer's life through covenant. They both are necessary. And that the law is part, therefore, of the gospel experience. And that gives us that very different approach to culture and life we see coming out of Lutheranism and the Puritan model. Why is the law so significant for the Puritans? He wants to move away from mutuality more to the idea of God's working his grace with a passive righteousness, that he actually attacks the law for fear that we're introducing the idea of the law obedience into the believer's life. That's an amazing thing when you hear some of the strong statements of Luther, where he says the height of Christian divinity is to deny the law. Okay, that's his teaching. And he struggles, and of course it's not surprising that the antinomian issue will break out in Lutheranism and have to be addressed. And Luther will have to struggle with the question, well, how does the law work itself out in the Christian's life if the Christian is to be ignorant of the law? Another statement that he has. No question, Luther said we must teach the law. So the question is, how does he put that together with the system, which I'm going to try to show you, really tries to emphasize that we must stay away from active righteousness. I mean, he'll talk about it, but he wants to really diminish it to make sure we rest upon Christ. And so he has to find a way to bring it back in. And to quickly answer your question, and we'll develop it more next time, he develops the idea of what we could call the principle of simul justus et peccator. Have you heard that phrase before? Simul just and sinner. And so the law is for the lost man in the Christian, the part of him that's not yet Christianized, but not for him as a Christian. So it then comes into the issue of the third use of the law. Is there the third use of the law in Lutheranism? There isn't. Now, later Lutheranism develops, but Luther struggles very much. And so the question, is there a doctrine of sanctification in early Lutheranism, is a legitimate question. Okay? The Pietists developed it, but did Luther have it? That's the question. Okay, and we'll talk about that some. Okay? Well, what happens next is that into that context, early on, we find Zwingli emerging. And Zwingli, in God's providence, was a Swissman and not a German. And that already caused enough problems to get along with between Zwingli and Luther. But not only was there that tension, there was also a question, to what extent was Zwingli dependent upon Luther in the discovery of the gospel? And Zwingli said, I learned it from Christ through the scriptures. I didn't learn it from Luther. I learned it studying the Bible. So there's even that sense of where Luther says, no, you got it from me. And he's, no, you didn't get it from me. From you. And the egos and the discoveries and the national rivalries are all at work. But it is interesting that one of the things that happens, and we'll see this when we look at Zwingli, is that Luther will eventually look at Zwingli and say that you are just of the papists. Your doctrine of obedience is the same as Rome's, because you're talking about the necessity of obedience. Because Zwingli will say the law and the gospel are one and the same. Okay, what? And Luther says, no, the law and the gospel are absolutely different. And Zwingli is going to come at that because he may be amazed at this because of his understanding of the covenant coming out of Genesis 17. We're going to go back and look at that. We'll see that Zwingli and Bullinger are going to say that when the Lord says to Abram in Genesis 17:1, walk before me and be blameless, he is bringing together justification and obedience into the believer's life through covenant. They both are necessary. And that the law is part, therefore, of the gospel experience. And that gives us that very different approach to culture and life we see coming out of Lutheranism and the Puritan model. Why is the law so significant for the Puritans? It's not just because we're trying to restrain sin, we're trying to love God. This is our faith at work. For Luther, we must be very careful before we impose the law upon the Christian, that we trust more to the power of a living faith to bring about obedience, and use the law more to constrain sin and attack sin, but let the believer's faith work itself out. Very interesting cultural models emerge from these systems. And it's no accident that the Puritan approach to culture, with its high emphasis on justice and its moral ordering of culture, grows out of a covenantal system because it's bringing the law to very high elevation. Okay? Those are just general statements, and hopefully we can introduce some things there. But another very interesting feature that I want to highlight just by way of survey is that right at the beginning, when Zwingli is developing his early notions of covenant, we find that the Anabaptists are also coming into their being. Remember, the Anabaptist tradition, in one of its most important forms, comes right out of Zwingli's converts. In 1525, the great beginning of the Anabaptist tradition begins as they baptize one another with milk buckets on Christmas Day. That's when they began. I think there's Blau Rock and Mons, and there's another one in there, Grable, I think. And as these three men did their work, Anabaptism began. By the way, it wasn't immersion. You know, they were pouring, which is a good point to always emphasize when I debate with my Baptist friends, that they believe pouring was a legitimate form of baptism. But be that as it may, the issue that comes out of that is that they begin to say, where do you find in Scripture, on the basis of sola scriptura, which is how Zwingli brought the Reformation to Zurich, where do you find infant baptism? And you may not know this, but there was a point where the Reformed tradition was that far from saying we ought to give up infant baptism. You can go back between Zwingli and other writers going back and forth saying, we're not sure if this is biblical. And Zwingli finally comes out and says, as I've struggled with this, the biblical warrant is the covenant. And he develops a very clear covenantal basis for infant baptism, which has, again, tremendous sociological implications, because he's arguing now for a church and state that can be identified, because every infant can be baptized and every infant is a member of the state. So you have instead of having a smaller church than the state, you find an organic union there with infant baptism, which is an important notion in Zwingli's view of church and state. But more importantly, it's in the challenge to Zwingli from the Anabaptist camp that we find the first full-blooded development of covenantal thought coming to bear. So we actually have covenants in conflict. The Anabaptist covenant of a believer committing himself to Christ in covenant versus a covenantal model of a family coming with their children. And those are in tension. And it's out of that dialectic that we find Zwingli beginning to perfect what's the theology in its initial forms that has been part of Reformed orthodoxy ever since. It's very fascinating to study those early points in history, how that emerges. So easy to see it monolithically, but in those early stages, you can look at the letters. There was actually a point where they didn't know where they're going to come down. We'll try to give you some of that highlight in the next couple of lectures. Okay, but out of that, eventually, we find Bullinger developing the first treatise that I mentioned earlier of the One and Eternal Testament or Covenant of God. And in there, he develops a singular covenant of grace. We do not find a covenant of works, a pre-fall covenant, but we clearly find an organically unified Bible around the theme of the covenant. He says all of the Bible must find its focus or its target in Genesis 17. Isn't that interesting? Did you know that Luther, when he commented on Genesis 17, said this chapter is dangerous for the Christian? Paul had to work with all of his energy to keep us from falling back into the error of circumcision. And here's Bullinger saying, this is the sum of all of our theology in this chapter. I've called that the hermeneutical watershed between Zurich and Wittenberg. It's Genesis 17. Okay, we'll look at that. So it's fascinating in the early history to see what's going on there. And then we come to Calvin. And again, Calvin is truly a conundrum. And I'll introduce this article here in just a few minutes, where we struggle with how do you put Calvin in all this? Because everybody knows that Calvin's one pet theme was predestination. And everyone knows that predestination emphasizes God's monolateral, monergistic redemption, and that there can't be any kind of mutuality or covenant breaking in a Calvinistic system. And yet, lo and behold, if you do a little study on Calvin, you'll find time and time again he'll talk about covenant breaking and violating the covenant and the mutuality of the covenant and the two sides of the covenant. And then you wonder, well, we've not read Calvin very well. Okay, so the issue of the article then, let's just jump off into this and the other things, maybe we'll come back just in the last couple minutes. I'd like you to read this article for next time to just give you a flavor for some of the debate. But basically the issue that I'm raising in this discussion from the Calvin Theological Journal, most recent edition, is that the covenant seems to be, in most people's minds, a notion that attacks predestination. In fact, Perry Miller's position was that the covenant theology really developed in New England to tone down predestination, so that we could get, again, if you will, some kind of potentia ordinata. We can get an ordained power in God. We have a covenant. We don't have to worry about this terrible doctrine of sovereign election. We can say, well, if we live the covenant, we can relax because we know how God works. We know you can take that same issue and you can move it to the Rhineland area. Heinrich Heppe, another German theologian that has written very wonderfully in certain areas of Reformed history, but Heinrich Heppe in this area, I think, is quite off base, but he says it was the Swiss-German tradition that was trying to correct the Calvinism that was going on under Calvin in Switzerland and France to correct its overemphasis on predestination. So he says in the Palatinate, under the very mild form of Calvinism developing under the Heidelberg Catechism and that tradition, we find a toning down of predestination through the covenant. Okay, so that's a model. And to some extent, Weir's approach by emphasizing a response to Beza would fit that tradition in some sort of way. That would be kind of the model he would hold. Yet there are others that take all kinds of conflicting views. What I try to argue in this article is that we can see a unified emphasis on sovereign predestination, yet worked out in the context of a mutual covenant. That we find that just as much in Calvin as we do in Bullinger, as we also do in Zwingli. The two works that I've asked you to look at, probably the most important one here that this article would challenge, would be McCoy and Baker and Trinerud. They have developed the idea of the tension between the Rhineland reformers and Calvin. Okay, so we've talked about the tension. Could it be in New England, as Perry Miller would suggest? Could it be in the Palatinate, as Heppe would suggest? Would it be in as early as the Rhineland reformers and Calvin? So you see this idea keeps coming up, and it's almost like none of the scholars have ever read each other. They're all writing independently, and yet they're all dealing with the same issue, but just different historical locations and times. And the McCoy-Baker thesis says that Bullinger held to a single form of predestination, not double predestination, that was developed in the context of a mutual covenant. Whereas Calvin developed a double predestinarianism in the context of a singular covenant. And Weir will develop the notion that it was really in reaction to Beza's superlapsarianism that covenantal thought comes into it. So this idea of the tension between covenant and predestination keeps coming out all the time. Okay? In that context, I'd like you to read this article, notice some of the range of research that's available in the footnotes, and they may suggest some topics for you to do some research of your own. I won't pursue that now. We'll come back to that more when we come to Calvin. Okay? But I'd like you to read that to get your feet stepping into some of the waters of the covenantal debate. What is my position in the article? It's very simply put that Calvin's, one of his unique contributions to covenantal theology is to bring covenant and election intimately together in his thinking. That instead of them being opponents and polarized, as some would suggest, we actually find that more than any of his other contemporaries, as far as I can tell, he is saturating his discussion of sovereign grace with covenantal responsibility. That's Calvin's contribution. So I say that the paradigm of the Rhinelanders versus Calvin does not stand the scrutiny of actual evaluation of Calvin's writings. And you'll see that when you read on your own. Okay? So that's a very important area, in my opinion, as we begin to see Calvin developing. I suggest also in this article in the last section under Calvin here, that one can also observe an elementary form of the covenant of works in Calvin's writings. Back in the Westminster Journal, spring of 1981, I have written an article here called Ursinus's Development of the Covenant of Creation, A Debt to Melanchthon or Calvin. And in there, I developed some of the arguments why we need to look at the development of the prelapsarian covenant as coming out of Calvin's thought rather than Melanchthon. The continental scholarship has argued that the prelapsarian covenant grows directly out of Melanchthon's Arminianist type thinking. He was a proto-Arminian, if you will. A lot of emphasis on synergism, our own effort. And you see, he was not Calvinistic and reformed on election either, even though he was a friend of Calvin's, which shows you the breadth of Calvin's churchmanship. He was willing to join hands with Melanchthon in certain areas, but they disagreed on the notion of sovereign grace. And continental theologians have said it was the influence of Melanchthon upon the German Reformed theologians in the Palatinate that helped give us, ultimately, then the covenant of works. And my argument there is that, no, you look again to Calvin. You can find that there was Calvin's influence. So that's another part of the debate. So I'm novel in my approach to history here. You can disagree with me. I don't say it's the gospel. But I'm convinced that Calvin is far more significant as a seminal thinker in covenantal theology than almost anyone else has been willing to say. There are a few exceptions of that. There's a Dutchman who wrote by the name of Vandenberg, who suggested this a century ago. And then also, more recently, some of the writers such as Herman Hoeksema, from Calvin Seminary. He's deceased now, but he very clearly developed, I think, a good beginning of this notion as well. And I appreciate his work and think he was on the right track. Okay, so that's some of the issues. So then how does the later early Reformed tradition play off of Calvin? Do we see federalism, if you want to call federalism the beginning of a pre-lapsarian covenant intention with a covenant of grace, if you want to use that as a term, then where do we see that coming from? It is clear that Ursinus and Olivianus are some of the earliest users of that phrase, Ursinus especially, because he speaks of a pre-fall covenant of law and a covenant of creation. Is that a changing of Calvin's focus, or is it an extension of it? That's a question. And I would argue that it is a development of ideas already in Calvin that are being further developed. So if you want to hear a model of how I see my relationship of Calvinistic covenant theology, and I've not defined those terms well yet, and later federal theology, I would use the illustration of the relationship of the Old and New Testament from a Reformed viewpoint. There is organic development, okay, that there is continuity rather than radical discontinuity or challenge. See, on a Lutheran model or an Anabaptist model, on a dispensational model, they emphasize discontinuity from Old and New Testament. Okay, that is my illustration of what I see between federalism and covenantal theology, that it is an organic development. And there are already early seeds that are not fully developed that come right out of Calvin. And I'll try to argue that later. And so that's the approach that I've tried to argue for as I've studied the question. Then there's another tradition that develops later, which is Coxaeus' approach. And in the Calvin Theological Journal, you'll see a nice article here that will introduce you to Coxaeus. He develops the notion of the fivefold abrogation of the covenant of works in Christ's redemption. So it's a very interesting now tension that exists between the covenant of works and the covenant of grace. That's a unique model of thinking that comes along. And then finally, as we conclude a quick survey here of the Reformed tradition, we want to say that by the time we come to the Westminster Confession, which to me really closes the Reformation era, with the writing of the Westminster Confession, in my opinion, you have to say the Reformation is largely concluded, and you're moving into what we could call the post-reformational era. You might even argue it occurs earlier, but it's clear that the English Reformation is concluded, and it's clear that the Westminster Confession is the most fully developed statement of Reformed theology. But it's different from other earlier Reformed traditions when it talks about the covenant, because it makes it a creedal point that the covenant of works is in fact something that a Reformed Christian must believe. Okay? That is not found in the earlier Reformed traditions. So you'll find, for example, in the Christian Reformed tradition, those who would attack the idea of a covenant of works. If you did that in a Presbyterian tradition, you would be really challenged as to whether you're an Orthodox Presbyterian. That's not true in all the Reformed streams of thought. In fact, some Reformed theologians outside of the Presbyterian or Westminster tradition will say that that's an intrusion of Puritan neo-nomianism into the Reformed tradition as an attempt to bring law and intrude it back into redemptive grace through the work of the covenant of creation. Okay, so that's part of the dynamic. And there, I think there's a fellow of one of the Reformed seminaries in Michigan who, by the name of Donald Brugink, who wrote a work challenging the whole notion of the covenant of works, saying it's just neo-nomianism breaking out in Reformed guise. Okay? It's destroying the notion of the grace of the covenant. And many writers outside of the Westminster tradition, and even some who come from it, would take that posture. Okay, that the covenant of works is an alien notion to Calvin's thought. It's a perversion of Reformation thinking because it's intruding human effort back into the work of God's free grace. And here we are in the Westminster tradition saying that you've got to believe this if you're going to get ordained in our church. So there's real tensions over that issue. And that comes up again later in because of the creedal character of the Westminster Confession. And I think the great value of Straley's work is that he gives to us the best one-place survey of the multiple Reformed thinkers that most of us will never get a chance to read. He gives us a lot of little synopses of the various writers. That's why he's worth reading. Some of his thoughts I would engage with and probably disagree with, but his great contribution is that he shows how the covenant idea develops between one writer to the next. And you'll see some of the development of the covenant of works and where it begins to show itself and different tensions that exist in that tradition. Well, when we come to the later developments, then finally, as we conclude our survey today in covenant theology, we need to realize that, therefore, Coxaeus by no means can be viewed as the tradition as a beginner, that the covenant tradition has a long beginning before Coxaeus, although there is the popular error that covenant theology begins with Coxaeus, or that federalism begins with Coxaeus. And both of those are just clearly wrong historically. We find the notion of a pre-fall covenant already before Coxaeus, long before him. But the later developments then are significant, and a couple suggestions as we conclude that we would want to emphasize. Samuel Rutherford's work, Lex Rex, is an interesting development of a commissioner from Scotland to the Westminster Confession who begins to develop the notion very clearly of covenant breaking and civil disobedience. Okay, so Rutherford represents an aspect of covenantal thought as it's again applied to the state. As the Christian sees the covenant between God and the king that limits his power, when he violates that covenant, what obligation does his subject have to him? And that is something, of course, that the Scottish people are going to struggle with, that will ultimately become part of the civil war that will unfold out of the Westminster context. Very critical issue. And that's found in Law and King, Lex Rex, and the covenant idea, which we saw anticipated in the medieval period, will come up in Rutherford. Arminius will actually develop the notion of a conditional election paralleling a conditional covenant. Okay, so that raises the question, how close is covenant and election? Also, Moses Amiro, the great four-point Calvinist at the School of Saumur. By the way, for all of you that are Philadelphians, did you know that William Penn actually lived in the home of this theologian? Moses Amiro had William Penn in his home as a student. He'd gotten kicked out of Oxford. He got sent to France. He studied. So even though he was a Quaker, an interesting question is, to what extent are his early thought in terms of law and government was taken from Reformed influence? And I would argue very substantially, if you look at his frame of government that he composed for Pennsylvania, you can go back and you'll see how he draws law out of the creational order. Almost in, looks like he's talking about a covenant of works. And out of that developing a system of government that out of which he develops a nation and its law. Very fascinating question. I don't know anybody who's even touched that question. So it's fascinating. It's out there for someone to pursue. Of some of those kind of issues of church and state, the influence of Moses Amiro on Penn and its impact on the early frame of government. That's a very fascinating question. But Amiro, fascinatingly, develops the idea that the Mosaic Covenant was to be included somehow, let's put it this way. He was developing the tension of how do you put the Mosaic Covenant into the covenant of grace. There's a sense it's part of it, there's a sense it's not part of it. How do you fit it? Does it become a distinct era in its own right? Do you deal with it entirely differently than you do the rest of God's redemptive era? So here's a French Reformed tradition developing another covenantal theology. Turretin and his writing will interact with Amirot's theology on the question of covenant. So that's a fascinating issue. We've already mentioned also later on the New England Puritans struggle with the problems of legalism and antinomianism, and also the question of the halfway covenant. And the covenant is right in the center of all of those debates. What does the covenant demand us to do? What does it make us do in conversion? What does it make us do in the obedience of our Christian life? And what happens if we don't measure up to a true conversion and yet we're in the church? What do we do with our children? We get the problem of the halfway covenant. And of course, covenant theology has continued to be a problem right up to the modern century. And the Bardian tradition has really largely struggled with the notion of a covenant of works. They reject it. Say there's no room for a covenant of works. And so Bard moves away from the Presbyterian Westminster tradition. So that's a brief survey. Again, just enough to get you a little bit of a sense if you've never looked at this thing. This may be totally a regurgitation of things for others of you, and for those of you in that category, I apologize. The next class we get together, what I would like to do is to take us into the process of moving from the late medieval tradition into Luther and to the mature Luther. We're going to try to look at Luther from his beginnings to his end to see how he engages the late medieval theology, modifies it, and I think ultimately discards it for his own unique Lutheran approach to theology. And we'll try to go to specific texts from Luther next time. The reading of this article is only designed as a way of getting you into some of the debate that's out there and introduce you to some literature that may suggest research for you. One last thing before we go. One of the other great values of Weir's work is at the end he has a very excellent bibliography of works on the covenant that you ought to consult so that you're looking for areas of interest. You may find something that's been written that will probe you into looking for an area of research. Okay, it's not exhaustive, but it's a very good survey of articles on the covenant, and I'd recommend you considering that. Okay, thank you. Remember, by next week, please try to have your proposal for your research paper for me.